Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
The Dodgers are going to the World Series. Now, if I had told you that a week ago or a month ago, you would not have been surprised. But admit it, if I told you that late Thursday night, you would have been right up in my grill. And you would have bet any amount of money you had. Because you would have said, and I could see where you might think so, that they were dead on arrival. DOA. You knew it. They were down 3-1. You assumed that they knew it. As the late, great Mike in San Diego would say, their pitchers weren't pitching well. Their hitters weren't hitting well. Their fielders weren't fielding well. And their fans weren't fanning well.
Our fans aren't fanning well.
Oh, and the bullpen was a straight disaster. Yet, they won on Friday night. Then they managed to grind out and win on Saturday night in a game where the bullpen did do its job. So sure, anything less than a ring was going to be a colossal disappointment this year for LA. But at least if they were going down, they were going down swinging. At least they were showing some serious grit and heart to force a game 7, no matter what happened. I mean, yes, the ring is the thing, but at least they did not lay down and die at the first sign of adversity. At least they ate a few haymakers, and they continued to stand in the center of the ring and trade. And most importantly, at least they gave themselves a chance. At least they got to a game 7, no matter how little you trusted their bullpen. They got there, and they got there with a little mo. They got there with some swag, and they got there, and it seemed like maybe, possibly, they had their mojo back. Until they fell behind in the first inning, 1-0. You see, that's the thing about the Atlanta Braves. It's not just that the Dodgers weren't playing well. It's that they had run into a buzzsaw. Atlanta was playing well. Atlanta is a damn good team. They're good right now, and they're going to be even better in years to come. They're relentless, and they sure as hell are not afraid of the big stage. They're not afraid of the moment. And they proved that again in the second inning when Dansby Swanson ran into this.
Let's the 1-1 fly. Swanson lifts a fly ball to left center field. Peterson going back. Dansby Swanson, upper deck home run. And the Braves lead it 2-0.
Upper tank. Dodger fan, be honest. At that point, you were not feeling it. You might have even switched over to the Rams game at that point, although that was not going any better. You were preparing to call in today and crush Dave Roberts. You were going to kill him, call for his job, demand that Clayton Kershaw retire, demand some big trades and some big free agent signings. Basically, all hell was about to break loose. You were going to call them chokers. You were going to say that the pressure gets to them, that they're the kings of the regular season, but nothing more than October scrubs. Admit it. You know you were coming with that. And that's just Dodger fan. That's the guy that loves his team. The rest of you are so much worse. But then Will Smith came up, and he came up with two men on.
The Dodgers aren't able to score on a two-out hit. Smith goes after it and grounds a base hit into center field. Turner's in to score. Muncy's headed for the plate, and Smith has delivered again. A two-run single ties the game.
All right, so now we're tied up at 2 apiece. And Smith continues to be one of the most clutch dudes on this team. He's had a total of 3 hits in the last 3 games, but 2 of them were massive. The 3-run bomb in Game 5, and then that RBI knock last night. But, again, Atlanta is relentless. They're not going away. Absolutely relentless. And no sooner than the Dodgers tied it up in the bottom of the 3rd, Atlanta takes a 3-2 lead in the top of the 4th. Like, every single time the Dodgers land a good shot, Atlanta counters with a bigger one. Now they've got runners on 2nd and 3rd. Nobody out. And a chance to bust this thing wide ass open against the much maligned arsonists in the Dodger bullpen. The very thing that anybody who had watched even one inning of this series was expecting. The Dodgers on the ropes, taking a beating, unable to defend themselves. The ref is taking a long look at them. You know, if the Braves land one more good shot, that ref's going to step in and he's going to stop the fight. except this happened.
With second and third, nobody out, the 2-2 pitch to Markakis. He swings and grounds one right to Turner. And now caught in a rundown is Dansby Swanson. And now Swanson is tagged out and going to third base. And tagged out is Riley, a double play. Some bad base running, and the Dodgers say thank you very much.
Yeah, the Dodgers got lucky also because that was not really a textbook rundown 100%.
Hey, listen. If you do not have a dog in this fight and you're neutral, you're laughing because that was comical. That was some of the worst base running ever at the worst possible time. I mean, that's some Little League bleep right there. But if you're a Braves fan, you're tripping hard and immediately thinking, man, that's going to come back. That's going to come back and bite us in the ass. That was one of the biggest blown opportunities ever. If you're a Dodger fan, you're thinking, that was one of the best moments in years. The great escape that allows us to stay in the fight. Because make no mistake, Atlanta was in position to end that fight right there. They had both hands around the Dodgers' throats. All they had to do was squeeze. Instead, they puke all over themselves. Swanson leaves from third on contact. You know, it's not the biggest crime ever. That's not the biggest sin of all time. But if you're going to go, you better get home. And if you're Austin Riley and you're going to leave from second, man, you better get to third. You can't start for third, then go back to second, and then start running back to third. The only time you ever see that in a game is when a bunch of nine-year-olds do it, and they're all crying after the game. And the coaches and the parents take them for ice cream and remind them, hey, hey, easy, kids. It's not like this was Game 7 with a trip to the World Series on the line. Except in this case, that's exactly what that was. So I wonder if Brian Snitker grabbed Swanson and Riley and the fellas and went looking for bomb pops. And the ice cream truck. Hey, by the way, when you're a kid, what's better than the ice cream truck? And bomb pops. And no clones. The degenerate driving the ice cream truck does not bump those tunes to muffle the screams in the back of the truck. He does it to let the neighborhood kids know that he's on the way. That he's here. That there are bomb pops and drumsticks. Remember how last week we were flashing back to some of the great moments of yesteryear in the jungle? That was one of those moments that, while not great, was definitely a yesteryear moment. Yeah, hey, Rome, don't you know why that guy driving that ice cream truck is bumping those tunes? To muffle the screams in the back of the truck. Oh, child molestation, that's funny. Not to me, it's not. Not then, not now. Anyway, there was some Little League bleep from the Braves. That's what that was. Little League bleep and some textbook execution by Justin Turner and the Dodgers to get that double play. Again, the Braves could have and should have busted things wide open. Instead, the Dodgers get out of that inning with limited damage and a hell of a lot more life than they expected. And then it was Mookie. Mookie Betts hits them with the paddles once again when he does this.
And now Freeman with a fly ball to right. Heading on back is Betts. He's at the wall. He leaps and he catches another one. He's robbed another one. He robs Freeman of a home run leaping over the yellow line. Mookie Betts is of another planet. My, oh my, what a play.
Does he have a trampoline out there to use?
Yeah, three straight games with a massive play in right field. That is the very definition of an MVP. A guy who is changing the game at the plate, on the bases, in the field, scoring runs, saving runs, bringing home runs back. But as great as that catch was, they were still down 3-2. That is until Enrique Hernandez pinch hits in the bottom of the sixth.
And seven pitches to the first man he faces here in Game 7. Another 2-2. Hernandez hits one in the air. Left center field. This game is tied.
That home run was tremendous. It was freaking majestic. An unbelievable, singular moment. But the entire at-bat was a tour de force. Coming off the bench, ice cold, working an 8-pitch at-bat. And then tying that game like that is legendary. A truly iconic LA Dodger moment. And you can talk all the junk you want about the Dodgers' payroll, or about how they're loaded with MVP candidates like Betts and Cody Bellinger. but they're also loaded with guys like Hernandez, somebody who played for two other MLB teams before he got to LA. Justin Turner was with two other big league teams before LA. Max Muncy was flat out released by the A's before they signed a minor league deal with the Dodgers, or he did. And those guys are every bit as important to this team as Betts and Bellinger. I mean, of course they're talented as hell. Everybody knows that. But they're also tough as hell. And not everybody knew that or believed that. In fact, when they fell behind 3-1, everybody believed that they were the opposite of tough. They thought they were chokers. They thought they had no grit. They thought they didn't have any clutch gene. That they were made of all the wrong stuff. That they were soft. Except they had a little something, right? They had a little something for all the haters. They had everything I just mentioned, and then they had this in the bottom of the seventh.
Eighth pitch has been the magic one tonight. This time he hits the ball to deep right field. Cody Bellinger has done it, and the Dodgers lead in game seven.
Boom! It was amazing. I know a number of you listening are business owners. If you are, you do not need to tell us that running a business is tough. It is really tough. But you might be making it tougher on yourself than it has to be. Don't let QuickBooks and spreadsheets slow you down any longer. It is time for you to upgrade. Upgrade to NetSuite. Stop paying for multiple systems that do not give you the information you need when you need it. Get rid of the spreadsheets and all that old software. Get rid of the spreadsheets and all the old software that's bogging you down that you've outgrown. Now is the time to upgrade to NetSuite by Oracle, the world's number one cloud business system. NetSuite gives you visibility and control over your financials, HR, inventory, e-commerce, and more. Everything you need, and it's all in one place, and you get it instantaneously. So whether you're doing a million or hundreds of millions in revenue, save time and money with NetSuite. Join the over 21,000 companies that are using NetSuite right now. Let NetSuite show you how they'll benefit your business with a free product tour at netsuite.com/Rome. Schedule your free product tour right now at netsuite.com/Rome. Once again, netsuite.com/ROME. Again, I don't root, and I have no dog in this fight, even though I'm an LA native. Don't come in here. Don't bring me that. Hey, Rome, how about your Dodgers? They ain't my Dodgers. But how do you not get caught up in a moment like that? That was incredible. You see, you watch sports for moments. That was a moment. No, correction. That was an all caps moment. A holy crap moment. Game seven, bottom of the seventh. Clutch as hell. Like, I've got no idea why Chris Martin was still on the bump after throwing 30 pitches the night before. I'm guessing that guy would have rather have been anywhere else on earth when that ball hit the bat, because he knew it'd be only a matter of seconds before that ball was ricocheting off some empty seats. And the amazing thing to me, the drama and tension in the MLB playoffs has been incredible, despite the fact that there have been no fans or limited fans at the games. Once again, I hate to keep going back to this point, but can you imagine if Bellinger had done that at Dodger Stadium last night? What a scene that would have been. And yes, I know he re-dislocated his shoulder in the celebration with Kike. Honestly, can you blame the guy? I mean, yeah, I know it's a little bit reckless, but in that moment, this guy had to be peaking on adrenaline. You're not going to come to home plate and just shake hands with your teammates or snap some selfie. Next time, maybe you do something like, I don't know, the old Mark McGwire fist bump, stomach punch that does not pop your shoulder out of your socket. But whatever. If his shoulder is back in place right now, and it is, I'm not going to sweat that. I can't stress this enough. At a time when everybody was calling them choking dogs and saying they had no heart and no grit, they showed extreme heart. They manned the hell up, and they did it against a damn good Braves team, and they kept their season alive by winning three straight. Three straight elimination games. Everybody was waiting to rush in and kill these guys, but they wouldn't die. They were the best team in baseball in the regular season, and they proved they're the toughest as well. Man, that is a mouthful right there. He is Tom Verducci. He is back. Tom, it's good to have you. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. How about you?
Good. Good to visit with you. So, Tom, let me start. If you were to go back before the start of last night's game when it was announced that the Dodgers were going to start Dustin May, what did you make of that decision?
I thought they were overthinking it. I thought Gonsolin was lined up to pitch. I didn't like the idea they waited until 1 o'clock in the afternoon, 6 hours before the game, to tell Dustin May he was starting. I'm not saying that had an effect on him, but I'd like my pitcher to know before he goes to bed he's getting a ball for a game seven. And they had it lined up, and the fact that they waited until 1 o'clock to decide tells you, you know, how much thought went into that. So, listen, I thought once they got away from whatever script they had early, I thought Dave Roberts managed a fantastic game. Ad-libbing, if you want to call it, although it's not, you know, see the pants stuff. Getting Blake Trinan in the game early, his high leverage guy earlier than he probably wanted to. Sticking with Urias when he was throwing lights out rather than, you know, just going to Kenley Jansen or whatever bullpen by formula. And the pinch hit Hernandez for Peterson at that spot in the game. It may have been obvious, but he hadn't done it before in some cases. So I thought once they got past the May-Gonsolin thing, I thought he managed a great game.
I think so, too. Tom Verducci joining us. So at that point, Tom, they fell behind 2-0. And as you've written for SI, in the previous seven games where the Dodgers have been eliminated, they scored a total of 9 runs. It had a feeling, Tom, like that might happen again. But then Will Smith tied it. They fell behind again. Then Kike comes up in the bottom of the sixth. What was the moment like in the stadium for that at-bat?
Yeah, it was pretty loud. I mean, considering there's 10,000 people there. And I thought the emotions of the Dodgers told me a whole lot of what they've been through and where they came back from in this series. For instance, Corey Seager said after the game when Kike hit the home run, he said, "That's the most excited I've ever been on a baseball field." And, you know, more so than the crowd, I just looked at that Dodgers side there, and they were going absolutely nuts. And don't forget, this season has been a grind for everybody, and especially this month where, you know, people are quarantined, you're in a secure zone, you really, unless they're in the zone too, you don't see your family. They really have only each other for a long time here. So I think it's one reason why you saw Dave Roberts get emotional after the game. But I'll tell you this, Jim, if there is a perfect way for the Dodgers to win the National League pennant, this was it. Because the Dodgers have been called a lot of things over the last few years, but scrappy ain't one of them. And the fact that they came from down 2-0 and then 3-1 and made up 2 deficits in the game 7, and they did it with these long at-bats, just kept winning these long at-bats all night long, that was the best way for this Dodger team to get into the World Series.
Tom Verducci joining us. You just hit, Tom, on two things that I think are so important. We talked, before you came on, I was talking about their grit and their heart and their courage, things that you're right, that they never really get credit for. But what about the at-bats and the approach? For instance, that Hernandez home run was great, and then an inning later, Cody Bellinger became a legend with his home run to put the Dodgers ahead for good. I mean, and both these guys had long at-bats. Kike's at-bat was an 8-pitch at-bat, and then you have Cody Bellinger. What's that say about the Dodger team-wide approach at the plate?
Yeah, there's no question, Jim. And because Cody's at bat, too, if you watch it, the foul balls, he had 3 balls just like Kike before he got the full count home run. He was just flicking balls to the left side. He was just trying to get to another pitch. And then when the pitcher, Martin, made a mistake, he absolutely hammered it. So that approach, you know, not try to hit a home run on pitches that really you really just need to foul it off if you can to do the best you can with it. You saw that all night long. And I have to go back to the Justin Turner at bat. I think it was the third inning. 2 outs, bases empty, and Ian Anderson, who's given up nothing in the postseason, has a 1-2. And he starts fouling off pitches, gets a 3-2, and gets a walk. And that started the two-run rally that Smith capped with the two-run single. So, listen, they saw 4.6 pitches per plate appearances. That I got to tell you, that is a ton. That is the most in the recorded history of Game 7 going back to 1988. They started keeping track of those things. So that, to me, you're going to see the same thing against the Rays because the Rays pitching staff, I mean, they don't care if they walk you. They'll nibble. They'll throw their breaking balls behind the count. The game right now is about defending home runs, especially when you're facing that Dodger lineup because they can go yard 1-9. So you're going to see the same kind of laborious at-bats in the World Series.
Tom Verducci joining us. I just think that from a hitting standpoint, Tom, that's not easy to do, to continue to foul pitches off and not try and do too much with them. And to your point, to try to live to see the next pitch, that is not easy for a batter. And then you also point out the Dodgers saw 175 pitches in last night's game. Like, how significant is that number, and how much of a toll does that take on an opposing pitching staff?
Yeah, that's only, remember, they didn't bat in the ninth inning, too, so that's
right.
Only 8 innings. Your point about the swings is really important, Jim, because again, with Hernandez and with Cody, you saw them use their B swings on 2-strike pitches, right? They weren't selling out, and so, okay, I struck out, no big deal. which happens a lot during the season, let's face it. But they're locked into the postseason environment. It's putting a beast swing on a pitcher's pitch with two strikes to get to another pitch. And they're not alone. I mean, Max Muncy, I mean, he doesn't swing at anything if it's an inch off the plate. They're wearing down pitchers, not just by seeing a lot of pitches, but by taking pitchers go, man, how did he take that pitch? I threw that exactly where I wanted. And then there's always the threat of the long ball, too. I mean, that to me is what wears you down. And I know that Tampa hit a bunch of home runs. They've actually scored, I think, over 70% of their runs in the postseason on home runs. But they're like Atlanta. The lineup is not as deep as what the Dodgers throw at you. So the attrition of having to work through 1 through 9 with no soft spots, long at-bats, that's what can wear down a Steph.
Tom Verducci is joining us. You know, Tom, to your point about how much grit the Dodgers have, Hernandez said after the game and for the series, quote, that was the first time this year that we were tested, end quote. And then as you wrote for SI, he was not the only player who felt that way. I mean, Dodger fans, Tom, I'm sure would have loved to have had a 4-game sweep. But how significant was it that the Dodgers had that test and they passed it?
Yeah, I think that's going to serve them well going forward here in the World Series. Who knows if they lose the first game, maybe the first two, whatever. Not that they would have panicked. They're too experienced. This is a battle-tested big-game team, right? But they hadn't been tested like this, as Hernandez and Mookie Betts both said. And I think they enjoyed that, Jim. I mean, this team has played with expectations from Jump Street, right? I mean, best team in baseball. How many times have we heard that? As Freddie Freeman said, we gave them a heart murmur in this series. We gave them everything that they could handle. And yet they made the plays when they had to make the plays. And they did. You talk about the home runs and the long at-bats. But the defensive plays by Mookie Betts and Justin Turner, those were huge. So this team came up big in big spots on both sides of the ball.
It's how much do you think that big game experience impacted the series? For instance, Atlanta has got a ton of talent, and they're a really young team, and we know they'll be back. I mean, they're going to be a force. But they're new to the big stage in Major League Baseball. When you consider, for instance, the base running mistakes that they made in critical moments in the series, how much of the series was decided by the team that just had more big game experience?
Yeah, well, first, I do agree with Freddie Freeman that team gave them all they could handle, and you're right. This team is just... they're just on the beginning of a window here that's opening for them. It's a super talented young team. But I do think there were moments where maybe the game sped up on them a little bit. I mean, it's hard for me to blame Marcell Ozuna, who's not really a young guy, for not tagging up. Mookie just made an incredible play. If you go back and look at that play, the magic of that play, and Mookie told me this after the game, was that he did not leave his feet. Most outfielders on that ball leave their feet to get their eyes down to the ball. But when you leave your feet, now the runner has more time to recover if he hasn't read it well, because you have to get up, throw the baseball. Mookie said, I had to stay up. It was an incredible athletic play, and I think it confused Ozuna. So I think it was mostly about Mookie. And then the base running blunder last night, you know, Swanson misread the ball. The infield's back in the middle. He should be going on contact, but only... he has to stay if it goes to Turner, who's in the 5.5 hole, and he had a bad read on it. But even once he's in a rundown, Riley immediately has to run to third base. Major League players do not get out of rundowns, unless you're Josh Harrison. That's an out once he's caught in a rundown. Immediately when he's in a rundown, Riley has to run to third base. Now you have first and third and one out. That's not so different from what would have happened if Swanson never ran, which was second and third and one out. So that mistake, I thought, was really, really critical. So, yeah, I have a hard time coming up with one mistake the Dodgers made the whole series that was as critical as those.
Yeah, right. I still have no idea. Watching that play out the way it did, I still can't believe that played out the way it did or that I saw that. All right, so a final thought, Tom. What about the matchup? It's a fascinating matchup in the World Series. How do you see that matchup playing out? Who do you like?
I do like the Dodgers, but again, I think this is a long series, especially now, don't forget, Jim, we're getting the 2 off days dropped in again, right? We went 7 straight through the LCS, but now we get 2 off, 3, and off again. That really helps the Rays, because if you thought Kevin Cash was maniacal with his bullpen in a 7-gamer with no off days, be prepared for long games, a million pitching changes, and guys with power stuff one after the other coming out of that bullpen. So that's why I think it's a close series. I think Dave Roberts has to be really careful with his starters. I think both Kershaw and Buehler, you cannot pitch them short. You know, you have to find them extra days in this series. So I would wait till 3 for Buehler, have him for 3 and 7. I would not bring him back short. You're going to have to throw a Gonsolin May game in there. So probably starting pitching-wise, it probably favors the Rays. But again, I just think the attrition factor that the Dodgers have, even against a staff like the Rays, will show up in the course of the series. They have more at-bats that they can win than Tampa Bay can.
So really quickly, Tom, I know you got to go, but what about Kenley Jansen? Do you feel like he got any of his mojo back? I mean, we know that Dave Roberts has been loyal to him. Do you think he can trust him fully? How do you think he uses him?
I do. It's a great story, too. Right before the LCS started, Kenley threw a simulated game, and they took video, and they sent it to his old pitching coach, Rick Honeycutt, and Charlie Huff, who was his pitching coach way back in A-ball when he converted from catcher to pitcher. They fixed the flaw in his delivery. And the ball came out of his hand his last two games better than it had for a month. I'm talking about velocity, spin, and break. Everything was a world different from what it was against the Padres in that division series game. So they have full confidence that this is the Kenley Jansen you've seen mostly in his better years. So he is going to get some high leverage spots.
All right, so there are a bunch of teams and moments and plays to hit on in my Monday recap, even if I'm late with that recap. But here is the biggest note from the weekend, and I just touched on this with his teammate Ryan Tannehill. My biggest takeaway from the weekend, Derrick Henry is a very, very bad man. A very bad man. If you didn't know, he reminded everybody of that fact when he memed Josh Norman last week.
He gives it to Henry. Henry's trying to get to the outside. Shoves the defender, Josh Norman, to his backside.
Come in against Derrick Henry. You better go low. Do not stand up with that man and let him just throw you out of the club.
I mean, like a little kid. Not a good NFL player in Norman, but like a little kid. Like, get off me. That's a reminder of how big this guy is, how strong this guy is. And then yesterday against the Texans, he showed the other part of his game, the part that makes him truly, truly unfair.
Give it to Henry. Looking for some room. Finds it. 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, 45, 40,
wow!
35, 30, 25,
yeah!
20, 15, 10, 5, end zone. Ladies and gentlemen, 94 yards. Touchdown, Titans!
I mean, that's just not right. In fact, that's all wrong. Derrick Henry lists at 6'3", 247. A 250-pound man should not be that fast. A 250-pound man should not be able to or even allowed to run away from DBs like that. That is the very definition of a cheat code. The way the world is supposed to work is you can be a big running back or you can be a fast running back, but you can't be both. You can't be able to flick 200-pound DBs off you like a bug, but also be able to run away from them like Chris Johnson. It's all jacked up. It's not fair. Even when I said that to Ryan Tannehill, he kind of chuckled like, it's not fair, but it's awesome. So, of course, when the Titans came back to take that game in overtime, thanks in part to some really strange decisions by Texans interim coach Romeo Crennel, of course they were going to put the ball in Henry's hands in the red zone, of course.
Tannehill is wide to the left. Henry is in the gun.
Okay.
It's the King Cat. Henry running to the left, into the end zone. Touchdown, Titans! Yo! Yo! Titans win 42-36 as Arthur Smith comes with the King Cat for the final 5 yards and the victory. And the Texan stunned. It's not the Wildcat, because that, ladies and gentlemen, is the King.
Right. Like the Texans were going to stop that. He ran for 212 yards yesterday, 212, and then another 52 receiving. Take that for data. And save your bullcrap about how all running backs are overvalued now in this league. Not all of them. And definitely not this one. What a nightmare for Houston. A nightmare. And speaking of nightmares, Kirk Cousins had a waking nightmare against Atlanta. As great as Henry was, Cousins was that bad. Here's his stat line. 343 yards, 3 touchdowns, 3 picks. It sounds like it's not great, but it's not that bad, right? Wrong. It was terrible. He threw all 3 picks in the first half. All 3 touchdowns came in garbage time. That's because garbage time started right after halftime. Oh, and because it all happened against a previously winless Falcons team. A winless Falcons team that just broke off its head coach and its GM. And this is how bad the Vikings are. This is how bad the Vikes are right now. They got hammered by a winless team that just fired its coach and its GM. And as for Cousins, it's not often that you have a game where you throw for three touchdowns and people are saying you should have been benched. This guy throws for three touchdowns. People are calling for his benching, and even he himself does not necessarily disagree.
The reality is, if the pace, you know, that I'm on in terms of the interceptions, if that were to continue, I won't finish the season. I won't, you know what I mean? So there's a little bit of, you got to improve, whether it's them telling me, hey, we got to improve, or them pulling me, you got to get better.
I mean, it's pretty honest, right? And when was the last time you heard a quarterback say, hey, if I don't get better, they're going to take me out. If I keep throwing these interceptions, they're going to take me out. But then again, it's not like he's saying anything that we don't already know. That's a team, the Vikes, that was not only supposed to make the postseason, but make some noise once they got there, do some damage once they got there. And they're garbage, straight garbage. And that's not like some lava mouth cracking open a mic and talking junk. You get hammered by a previously winless team that just did fire its coach and its GM, and you fall to 1-5, you are garbage. Period. Garbage. Like, Adam, what would you call a team that dropped to 1-5 that just lost to a winless team? And that game was over at halftime. Right. But you know me. I'm about keeping it real, but mostly I'm about keeping it positive and finding the silver lining in pretty much anything. So know this. With that in mind, the Vikings are garbage.
Garbage.
However, they're not in the same class of garbage as the New York Jets. And saying that they are is not only inaccurate, it's pretty much a reason to go. Right? Somebody spits in your face, you go. Somebody insults your lady, you go. Somebody threatens your family, you go. Somebody says something derogatory about your race or your religion, you go. Somebody says the Vikings, or anybody else for that matter, are as crappy as the Jets, you go. These are all universal reasons to go. Miami just humiliated the Jets 24-0, and it could have been so much worse. It could have been so much more embarrassing. They took their foot off the gas. They showed mercy. They showed empathy. Joe Flacco started for the Jets. Remember all that is Joe Flacco elite nonsense? Only a few years back. I'm here to say he actually is. He is elite. He's in a special group. He's a perfect fit for the Jets. He led the offense to 13 first downs, but 10 punts. I mean, that's a ratio right there. Nearly as many punts as first downs for an NFL team. And it led to this legendary moment in the fourth quarter.
Third down and four. Here comes Eric Rowe chasing Flacco. Flacco now looking at Agba, and he drags him down. A monster loss. Second sack today for Agba.
That is laugh out loud funny. I mean, that really is funny. Have you ever seen a 28-yard sack before? And it looked like a 40-yard sack. Have you ever seen a 28-yard sack in an NFL game? Amazing. Only one team could pull that off. And it's not just that the Jets were shut out, or that their quarterback was taking a 28-yard sack, or that they were shut out and nobody else has been this year, or that they were shut out when teams are putting up points at a record clip, or that they were shut out, or they had a 28-point sack. Only the Jets could elevate that to a whole new level by having their coaches argue with each other in the media. And that happened on Friday. Triple G, Greg Williams, was talking about the fact that the Jets were allowing 32 points per game. And if you know anything about Triple G, you know there's no way he was going to wear that number. No way he was going to wear a number like that. No way is that on Triple G. He said, quote, "It's not a very good number, and a lot of it's not all defensively," end of quote. And of course, when asked to elaborate on that, Triple G responded with, quote, "You'd have to figure it out," end quote. Hell yes. He just went after the offense. The guy who's looking to affect the head just affected the head coach. And the head coach is old Crazy Eyes. And old Crazy Eyes was pissed off. He and Triple G apparently had a meeting. And then, in the meeting with the CBS broadcast crew, Crazy Eyes reportedly said, quote, "That's not what we need. No one is pointing fingers. We all need to pull in the same direction. Everyone needs to shut up and play." End quote. Actually, Crazy Eyes, people are pointing fingers. That's the D coordinator, Triple G, pointing it at you. And he didn't even try to hide it. He and everybody else there is covering their own ass now. And then Crazy Eyes was still bent about it after yesterday's game. They get shut out. They're still winless. They're far and away the worst team in the NFL. And he's still bent that Triple G was divisive and pointing the finger at the offense.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't happy about it, but I mean, we talked about it and, you know, he knew that it just, you know, right now I feel like our players are doing such a good job as far as trying to get things righted. And, you know, it's just everything we say is, it matters, you know, and he understood that we got to set the right example.
Yeah. Hold up there for a minute. G-man, you just lost 24-0. You're 0-6. And you're saying that the players are doing, quote, such a good job as far as trying to get things righted? The hell are you talking about? Who the hell are you kidding with that? Never forget, the Jets fired Todd Bowles so they could hire Crazy Eyes. Never forget that. Then again, that wasn't even the worst post-game presser of the entire weekend. And I've got more on the Jets. If I have time, I'll get to it. I'm not done with them yet. But I want to talk more about the post-game presser of the weekend. That wasn't even it. No, that honor goes to Bill Belichick. The hoodie watched Denver Bronco Brandon McManus single-handedly, or should I say single-footedly, destroy the Pats with 6 field goals in an 18-12 win in Foxborough. That was a really ugly performance by the Pats all the way around. And after the game, Belichick was asked if the lack of practices recently played any role in that defeat.
How much did the limited amount of fully padded practice time you've had in recent weeks do you feel had on today's game?
Yeah, I don't know. But you want a percentage? I have no idea.
So, like, if you heard that and your reaction to hearing that was to laugh or to say something like, oh, classic Bill, if that's your reaction, you're part of the problem. Because there's nothing cute or funny about that, man. That act is so tired. It is so tired. And don't come in here and say that, yeah, well, you never say anything positive about them. That's not true either. I said lots of positive things about them when they signed Cam and when Cam got off that great start. But that whole act, that Belichick act, where he just grunts and grumbles and says things like, you want me to put a little percentage on that?
But you want a percentage?
You want a percentage?
But you want a percentage?
Hey, Bill. You just got your heads handed to you by a team that came in with 1 win. You just lost at home to a team that threw 3 interceptions. Maybe you should answer the questions. This is the guy who is all about do your job. Yeah, well, the reporters are there to ask questions. You are there to answer questions. They did their job. Now do yours, Bill. Do your job. Answer the question. Meantime, it feels like it was only about a week ago that people were saying that Philip Rivers was a shot fighter, that he was old, that he was washed. I mean, it really is now the favorite shout of any sports fan. Just call somebody old and shot and washed. And Rivers was getting a ton of that last week. And it was happening once again yesterday when the Colts fell behind the Bengals 21-0. Then Rivers threw a couple of touchdown passes in the second quarter, and the Colts were within 3 at the end of the half. Then the Colts took a 28-27 lead in the second half. And then Phillip did this early in the fourth.
Second down. Rivers off play action. That one's going to be intercepted. Picked off by Jesse Bates. Bates up and on the move. Jesse Bates across the 45 and down near midfield.
And then immediately the Twitter mob erupted again. There he goes again. Bring in Jacoby Brissett. If it's the fourth quarter of a close game, it must mean that Rivers is going to throw a pick. Where's Jacoby? Except after Cincinnati missed a field goal, Rivers led the Colts on a 10-play drive. It resulted in a field goal, it extended Indy's lead, and then the Colts defense closed it out with a pick. He's been through it before. He's been there before. The old vet was not about to panic.
There really was no panic. You know, again, I'm new to these experiences with this football team, the culture and everything set and what we expected. So I wasn't feeling any panic from anyone.
He's been there before. Maybe not with these guys, but he's been there before. So from down 21-0 to win 31-27. Yeah, maybe Rivers is not perfect, but this guy's not a shot fighter. He's not washed. He's got something left. Maybe one game is not enough to go on for your snap reactions and your piping hot lava takes. But he brought them back. They got that win. And yes, I know what your snap reactions are when it relates to Cleveland and Pittsburgh. Yes, the Steelers beat the Browns down like they always do, and especially in Pittsburgh. Yes, it was a massive performance by the Steelers in every facet of the game. Yes, Baker Mayfield was running for his life. Yes, the Browns never got that great running game untracked. And yes, Mike Tomlin had every right to say, quote, "That was varsity ball today. They stepped up and stepped up big all across the board." That's fair. That's accurate. And it's a perfect description. That was varsity ball. And a banged up Browns team did not play varsity ball yesterday. They know that. But I've said it before, and I'm going to say it again. It's not about winning in October. You want to beat the Steelers in October, or you want to beat them in January? That's what I thought. Bad day for the Browns. Great day for the Steelers. I'm not jumping off that bandwagon. Hey, listen, did you know that a fire department responds to a fire every 24 seconds? October is, in fact, Fire Prevention Month, and we have teamed up with First Alert, the most trusted brand in fire safety, to help you get ready for the unexpected and review some key safety tips. Smoke and carbon monoxide alarms help provide an early warning in the event of a home emergency. And having enough First Alert smoke and carbon monoxide alarms is one of the very best things that you can do for your family. What you want to do is make sure you install alarms on every single level and in every single bedroom of your home. Once the alarms are installed, it is important to maintain them by testing them with regularity. Remember, alarms do not last forever. They do need to be replaced every 10 years. If you can't remember the last time that you replaced yours, it is best just to replace that unit completely. And my favorite replacement option is the First Alert Combination Smoke and Carbon Monoxide Alarm with a 10-year sealed battery. This alarm provides 2-in-1 protection against smoke and carbon monoxide both. And I don't even have to change the batteries for a decade. I love that. Also, remember, take this time and discuss home safety with your family. Plan and practice an escape route, and remember to practice that at least twice a year. And for more information on fire safety products, safety tips, and educational activities that you can do at home with your family, just go to firstalert.com/fireprevention month. I've done this with my family. We continue to do so. You should too. Bucky Brooks is my guest. Bucky, it's great to have you back. In fact, Bucky, it's been a minute or so since we've spoken. So before we get into the matchups, how are you doing? How is life for you right now?
Everything is good, man. I can't really complain, Jim. It's been a weird time, but it's been a good time. So things are good. Football is back, so I'm all good.
Good. Good to hear it. Bucky Brooks, my guest. All right, so when you watch the Tampa Bay defense, let me start right there. When you watch what that defense, Bucky, did to Green Bay yesterday, what kind of thoughts do you have about the job that Todd Bowles has done with that unit?
Man, I think Todd Bowles has done an excellent job. Like, what he's done with this defense is he's taking a collection of veteran players up front and sprinkling in some young guys in the back end. And what you saw against Green Bay was this defense really coming together and playing like we thought they would play. Up front, and Ndamukong Suh, Jason Pierre-Paul, Shaq Barrett dominating, Devin White and Lavonte David really making plays at the second level. But then these young guys, Carlton Davis and Jamal Dean, Antoine Winfield Jr., those guys playing, and all of the conversation and attention has been on the Buccaneers' offense and how Tom Brady's going to lead them to the Super Bowl. But what I thought you saw against the Packers, the defense, Ronald Jones in the running game, and then a little bit of Tom Brady in the passing game, that's the recipe for them to have success.
We are talking to Bucky Brooks. All right, then. As long as we're talking, Bucky, about defenses, let me jump ahead. We're talking about the Steelers' defense. What do you think when you watch them and you see the level they're playing at right now?
Mike Tomlin has done an excellent job of getting this unit ready to play. They've done it in, really, I would call it like a different style. This is a team that is blitz-heavy. They do a lot of five-man pressures. They're bringing pressure from all over. They still have the customary Pittsburgh Steelers physicality and toughness. But what they've done is by being so aggressive with the pressures, they really put the onus on the quarterback to make decisions quickly and playing a little zone with some man behind it. They make you make decisions under duress, and a lot of quarterbacks are wilting under the pressure. We saw Baker Mayfield melt down under the pressure, and I think they do this to a lot of quarterbacks, and they stop the run game. And so they make you play one-dimensional. They put a lot of pressure on your quarterback to get it right. I'm curious to see next week when they play the Tennessee Titans what this defense looks like when they're dealing with Derrick Henry and Ryan Tannehill and the balance and the physicality that the Tennessee Titans also bring.
Bucky Brooks joining us. I'm glad you brought that up, Bucky. I was going to ask you about that next. Like, I've got Ryan Tannehill coming on next hour, as I mentioned. I know that you think very highly of him. You've written about him. And in fact, Bucky, you've said that he needs to be considered one of the better quarterbacks in the game. Can you lay that out for everybody? What sets Tannehill apart from most other NFL quarterbacks?
Well, Jim, like, since he moved over to the Tennessee Titans, he's played at a high level. His numbers are favorable to Pat Mahomes over the last 14 games, or 15 games now. You've seen him really just kind of take ownership of his offense. And last year, it was easy to dismiss his success, saying, hey, Derrick Henry's really the driving force. He's playing with the rushing champ. He didn't really have to do anything. So, yes, he led the league in passer rating, but it's a little inflated. But now that he's come out in the first five games, he's continued to be the same player that we saw. We have to consider him a guy that is inching towards top five status because he has been that good. And the numbers and the tape suggest that he's played at that level.
Listen, I agree with you. And it's no secret, Bucky, that his career has taken off since he left Miami. How much of that is about the coaching staff that he played for in Miami?
I think it has to be a lot. Like right now, this season, the last 2 years have been an indictment on Adam Gase. I think you look at all the good players that were in Miami that have since gone on, Jarvis Landry. You look at Devontae Parker, who's there playing like a all-star. Ryan Tannehill not having success in Miami but going to Tennessee. I think he didn't get the right kind of coaching for him in terms of molding the system to fit his talents. And I will say that Arthur Smith in Tennessee has done a great job of building a system that is really team quarterback friendly and has really set Ryan Tannehill up for success.
I'm so Bucky, having said all that, how do you explain the fact then, and you've been around that league a long time, how do you explain the fact then that if you go back to 2015, when Adam Gase was the offensive coordinator at Chicago, his offenses have not finished better than 21st in total offense every year since then, yet he has this reputation for being a guru, an offensive genius. How do you explain that? What is that?
It's the Peyton Manning effect. Peyton Manning endorsing him having success when Peyton Manning was around, it made it easy. And so people have given him the credit for the success that should have gone to Peyton, for Peyton running the system that he's always run. And for whatever reason, I don't know what the fascination was with Adam Gase when he's down in Miami, because I didn't see that team play at a higher level. Sometimes guys get these narratives written about them that are hard to dismiss. I think now we're nearing the end of that, because we've seen that his team is just not dynamic on offense, and he doesn't have the ability to take the pieces of the puzzle to put them together where they can score a lot of points, and it doesn't matter the level of talent that he has or doesn't have around him.
We were talking to Bucky Brooks. So, Bucky, what about the Jets overall? Like, when you look at the results on the field and then the messes off of the field with the likes of Jamal Adams, Le'Veon Bell, and more, where are the Jets right now overall as an organization?
I mean, it's a mess right now. I think that's the only way that you can consider it. It's a team that is not winning a lot of games. It's a team that, when you look at their roster, there's not a lot of talent. And the talented players that they did have, they've kicked out of there. Jamal Adams going out, say what you want. He won a new contract. They didn't want to do it, so then they let him go. But he's a blue-chip player. Le'Veon Bell didn't work out there. Some of that, I would say, is due to the system. Some of that was maybe him. But they are just at a bad spot. And now with Sam Darnold, they have to make a decision on the young quarterback, because the fifth-year option, the decision has to be made in the offseason. But can you justify keeping him around based on how he's played? Can you pin that on another coach? Do you bypass a potential Trevor Lawrence or Justin Fields to stay the course with Sam Darnold? a lot of decisions that have to be made in New York. And then, oh, by the way, if they don't, if they move on from Adam Gase, who is the right coach to get this franchise back in track? A lot of stuff that Joe Douglas has to sort out.
We're talking to Bucky Brooks. Excuse me, Bucky. I was going to ask you about Darnold. So, like, when you look at him right now, say they move on from him and he gets an opportunity and a fresh start someplace else, like, what does he look like to you? Does he look like the guy that could befit where he was selected in the draft? Or does he look like a NFL starter to you and just another starting quarterback in that league? What do you think of his upside at this point?
I don't think he's certainly played to the level where he was drafted. I don't think anybody can justify and say that he has done that. I say he looks a little bit like the player that we saw at SC, who was talented, with flash, but there were some inconsistencies that showed up in his play. I think he's continued to do that. I think the big thing for him, there were people that liked him when he was coming out, and I don't think those people would necessarily move off of that opinion until they were able to either get their hands on him and really see what he looks like when he has maybe better coaching and a better supporting cast. But I will say it would be hard for me to give up a first-round pick for Sam Darnold if he was on the trade market, because I don't know if he's played at that level to justify him being considered a blue-chip player now or even in the future.
Bucky Brooks is breaking it all down for us for a few more moments. All right, so Bucky, you've got Kansas City and Buffalo playing tonight in that rescheduled game from last Thursday. Both teams are coming off their first loss of the season. What are you looking to see from Kansas City tonight?
You know, I just want to see them get back on track. And I think part of the reason why we've seen them inconsistent is because they are seen as coming off the championship. And so it's kind of been easy to them. They feel like they can flip the switch. Well, now that they've lost and they lost to the Raiders, I want to see if they can play an A game against what I think is a really good Buffalo Bills team. So can Pat Mahomes be on the mark? Can he get dialed in with this track team of wide receivers that he has on the outside? And then can Steve Spagnuolo challenge Josh Allen to make pinpoint throws against maybe his own defense? I just want to see them play well because everyone believes that they're the best team in the AFC. We just want to see them play at that level because right now Tennessee and Pittsburgh have been more consistent. They played better. But let's just see if Kansas City can show us and remind us why they are the defending champs.
Right, Bucky, and it seemed like Buffalo might have been in that same conversation or that same class, and ultimately they might be, but they got manhandled by Tennessee last week. How are you expecting the Bills to show up tonight?
Well, I think they'll play better because I think it's a powerful bunch. I think Sean McDermott certainly has the attention of the team after they got whooped by the Tennessee Titans. This will be a better team than the one that we saw on Tuesday night. They have to play the right way, though, meaning Josh Allen has to take care of the football. They got to generate plays. And then defensively, they have to play as one. What we saw against Tennessee Titans, the physicality and the toughness, the way they overwhelmed them, I need to see them step up. I need to see the Buffalo Bills display more toughness, more physicality, impose their will a little more than they showed on Tuesday night.
Bucky Brooks, my guest. Bucky, one last thought. Going back to last night, you made the point when you were watching the Sunday night game about the 49ers and the way they use their receivers and the fact that they're bringing back the wing back. How do you like Kyle Shanahan's approach when it comes to using his receivers?
Love it. I love what he's doing. He is so cutting edge in a very simple and traditional way. They're a two-back team. They utilize their wide receivers as wing backs, meaning, look, they put them in the running game. They run reverses and in the round. They get it to them. The guys that they got have that level of physicality, toughness, and running skill that you want to see from your wideouts because you can give them the ball and let them do more than just be wide receivers. And the way they use George Kittle is the ultimate hybrid at tight end. He's half offensive lineman, half wide receiver. He's the best blocker at the position, but he really can get open. And so when you think about Debo Samuel, Brandon Ayuk, George Kittle, there are a lot of weapons. It's now just about Jimmy Garoppolo being consistent enough to take advantage of what they have.
Hey, Bucky, really quickly, I got into this with a buddy of mine last night, but if they were both free and clear, who would you hire, Sean McVay or Shanahan?
Man, they both are really good. I think I would lean towards Shanahan just because he may have a longer track record of being able to do the offensive thing. I think they both are very good. However, I will say this with both of them. They have to prove that in the big game, the ultimate game, that they're able to adapt and adjust to whatever is going on in the game. For Shanahan, how do I play with the lead? How can I use my offense to protect my defense? And for Sean, is what adjustments can I make in-game to get my offense back rolling when someone shows us something that we haven't seen? Both of those guys are A-plus coaches. You just want to see them make those kinds of adjustments in the big game so they can be considered kind of the top of the bill and give them the same kind of, I guess, reverence that we give a Bill Belichick and Andy Reid and Sean Payton in terms of the holy grail of coaching.
Let's quickly go to San Luis Obispo. Brett in SLO. Hey, Brett, what's up?
Hey, I love all the Dodger love, but, man, you got the realities. They are literally on the knife's edge of becoming the Buffalo Bills, you know, on a national scale. I mean, I call them from the 805, showing my Dodger love. Don't get me wrong. I love the show. My kids love the show. You know, they want me to call in. They're the ones who want me to call in. But the thing, you know, I can reiterate that point about them being so close to being epic failures again. But the thing that I was calling about is your perspective and the show's perspective. You know, you talk a lot of Dodgers and Lakers, but I mean, that's because everybody is, right? I mean, everybody's talking about them. They're the story. They have been for the last few years, the Dodgers. The Sports Illustrated covered the best team ever. No, you know, they haven't lived with those expectations. But now going back to being from the 805 Central Coast, we got a lot of passionate fans from all over. I mean, you got a lot of Giants fans, you got a lot of Dodgers fans. So, and then the biggest Cubs fans I know actually, you know, live here too. But you have all kinds of people talking with different perspectives. And man, myself included, I was watching the game with my kids, my wife, and my daughter was, I mean, she was irate. She was ready to lay into Roberts about, you know, the early hooks, not just yesterday, but throughout the series. And I could just see everyone's ready to sacrifice him and throw him under the bus, just like, you know, the Kershaw.
Brett, let me do this because I'm jumping in because I'm at the bottom of the hour. Like, I ran late. Let me jump in and respond. What's going on, Matt?
Romulus James, hey, from Laurel Canyon to Vermont Avenue, from Santa Monica Boulevard to La Mirada, you're welcome. L.A. is feeling it today, Romy. You know what? We had an epic comeback. My man Dave Roberts was managing Irv's and all the haters, you know what you could do because we're going to the World Series. The Dodgers are back in the big show, Romy. And you know what? I'm going out. I'm not going to do an Ira Craig blanket prediction. Nah, it's going to be the Dodgers over the Rays in six games. It'll be a hard-fought World Series, but my man Kershaw is going to set the tone tomorrow, and we will be world champions like the Late Show. War Ira Craig using PVC pipe as a smoking cable. War Drizzle using a corn cob as a cigar. But unwar all the Dodger haters, because L.A. is Championship City 2020.
What's a smoking table? Ryan Tannehill is my guest. Ryan, nice to have you on the program. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you, Ryan. So you're coming off that overtime win over Houston yesterday. I'm curious, how nice is it to wake up on a Monday after a big win like that?
Oh, it's huge. You know, it's been a wild couple of weeks for our team, as you know, with the whole COVID situation. So, you know, we've been out of whack for a little while as far as just the rhythm of the season. So it's nice to have a full 7 days to prepare for this next game.
Ryan Tannehill joining us. It has been a wild couple of weeks for everybody, but especially the Titans. You know, Ryan, Mike Vrabel talks about your control and calmness in those moments. I'm curious, as a quarterback, are you consciously able to dial down the intensity of the moment, or is it something that you've been through enough times that you know what it's like and you don't need to consciously do it? Is it just natural at this point?
Yeah, I think it's a little of both, honestly. You know, the more times you're in a situation, the easier it is to take a step back and just focus on one play at a time and marching football down the field. And also, I think every time I go in, I try to just settle myself, take a few breaths, a quick meditation, and just really lock in before jogging out onto the field. So I think it's a little of both of settling yourself and then just having the experience and belief in the guys around you that, you know, we're going to get it done.
Titans quarterback Ryan Tannehill, my guest. Ryan, speaking of the guys around you, one of the things that comes up time and time again from your teammates is your accuracy and the fact that you put the ball right where your teammates want it every single time. How much pride do you take in that accuracy, and what is the secret to it?
It's huge. You know, I think it's a big part of what we do. Obviously, it's no secret that we like to do the play action game, and We have the playmakers that we have, Jonnu Smith with A.J. Brown, Corey Davis, Derek out of the backfield. If you're able to give them a good, accurate ball on the path they're running, then you know they're able to take either shorter mid-range completions and take them the distance. So something I take a lot of pride in. I work extremely hard at just being accurate on each and every throw I make.
We're talking to Ryan Tannehill. You mentioned Derek out of the backfield. Derek Henry had a couple of enormous moments yesterday. He had that 94-yard touchdown run. I mean, after seeing what he did to Josh Norman last week and then seeing him run away from DBs the way he does, Ryan, the word that comes to my head anyway is just unfair. That a guy that big can do things like that seems unfair. What does it mean to you and the team to have him playing at this level?
Oh, it's huge. You know, Derek is special. I've said it time and time again. You know, I saw it from afar. Before I came up to Tennessee, just him making extremely good plays. And people don't realize the speed that he has being as big as he is. You know, it's rare to see the combination of size and speed. You see big backs who are able to hit the hole and get those tough yards inside, break tackles. But I can't think of any other 250-plus pound running backs that are able to not only get those tough yards inside, but if they do get in the open field, stiff arm, make a guy miss, and then be able to outrun everybody 95 yards. So it's pretty pretty fun to watch, and glad he's behind me.
We're talking to Ryan Tannehill. Ryan, I know you don't want to make it about you, but your journey to this point is pretty amazing, and it's pretty inspirational. It was not that long ago that you were traded. You were a backup. A lot of people in your spot might have given up or felt like it was just not going to work out or you couldn't catch a break. That's not the way you approached it. You didn't do that. How did you go about approaching that time, and what was your process like?
Yeah, honestly, I didn't know, what was going to happen. Obviously, I wasn't in the position that I wanted to be in. I still felt I had a lot in the tank, a lot more to give. But being a backup was a position I was in at the time. So I tried to do everything I could to continue to improve, get better, and be the best backup I could and just kind of bide my time. I didn't know if it was going to happen. I didn't know if I was going to get an opportunity for whatever reason, either here or somewhere else. But I knew if I did, I wanted to do everything I could to take advantage of it and not look back. And, thankfully I was able to get an opportunity last year and try to take advantage of it.
I think that's really, there's a great story in that. There's a great message in that, stay ready and take advantage of the opportunity. Make sure you have no regrets and never look back. Now you're working with USAA and the USAA Salute to Service Virtual Lounge, and you're going to take part in an exclusive Chalk Talk for military members, vets, and their families tomorrow night. Can you lay that out for me? What is the Salute to Service Virtual Lounge, and why did you want to get involved?
Yeah, you pretty much said it. It's a virtual lounge where, veterans or current military members are able to submit their questions at salutetoservice.com. They can do that today or anytime tomorrow before 7 p.m. Central. I'll log on at 7 p.m. Central and be able to interact virtually with these members and their families, which is really cool, something I'm excited about. I was able to do it down in Miami. Personally, we were able to get together Super Bowl week and have that interaction in person. But with the times being what they are right now with COVID and everything, I think it's pretty cool that we can do it virtually.
That is. So how do members of the military community and veterans connect to the lounge? How do they take part in the event if they want to?
Just go to salutetoservice.com. They'll find out more information there. Salutetoservice.com/lounge. It has, I believe, all the information that they need.
Hey, Ryan, really quickly, what's it like for you to talk to members of the military and the folks that are making the sacrifices they're making? And then what are the types of things they talk to you about?
It's huge. It's such a blessing for me to be able to interact and have these conversations. I have so much respect for the people serving our country, both home and abroad. Not only the men and women who are in the service, but their family members as well. They give up so much and sacrifice so much time and security and all those types of things by serving our country. So I'm so thankful for that and love to give back and have these conversations if I can. And we do talk. They're asking me about football. I'm asking them about military life, where they're from. And it's just pretty cool. We actually have a base near Nashville here called Fort Collins. And hopefully we'll get some of our members from that base logging on tomorrow night.
That is pretty cool. One last thought, Ryan. Whenever I talk to your teammates from the defensive side of the ball on the show, we always end up talking about what it's like to play for Mike Vrabel because it seems like it's a lot of fun. It looks like it's a lot of fun. What's it like for you as an offensive guy to play for Vrabel?
Myself. I said Fort Collins. It's Fort Campbell. I'm sorry. I put my foot in my mouth there. Fort Campbell. But Coach Vrabel is pretty cool, man. He's a guy, obviously did it at a high level for a long time as a player, and now as a coach, he's able to bring that experience that he went through as a player and transitioned it into coaching. He's such a knowledgeable guy. He's smart. He's sharp. He's into it with all the situations that come up within a football game, and I have a ton of fun playing for him.
Titans are 5-0. Their quarterback, Ryan Tannehill, is a Pro Bowler, a comeback player of the year, and appeared courtesy of USAA and the USAA Salute to Service Virtual Lounge. Ryan, great to get caught up. Thanks so much. Appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Good night now!